It's Monday, July 3rd, 2006, and you're listening to Episode 8 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 59 minutes. All right, let's do something here just to mess things up a little bit. I'm going to introduce the host, starting on my left.
Oh, snap. Yeah.
In forward order of manliness this time.
So with me, I have John.
Hello.
Adam.
Hi.
And Chad.
Hi.
I'm medium manly.
You're medium manly.
Either way, we cut it.
Now, for those of you that have been following along in your textbook, I won't apologize because...
Not a textbook. The campaign setting.
No, this is the textbook for the podcast. You see, two podcasts ago, we talked about how the second edition Monstrous Manual makes a great outline for a campaign, but it also makes a great outline for a podcast. And last time, I forgot to tell everyone that that was actually the Aboleth podcast. So I want to get everything back on track. If you've got your textbooks in front of you, you want to turn to page 7, because this time we are on the Ankeg.
What is an Ankeg?
Well, it looks... It looks like an ant. I mean,
that's what it looks like.
I just show you the picture, but that won't help very much on a recording.
Maybe rub the book up against the microphone.
Yeah,
will that help?
I only do that in my spare time.
That's what an Ankeg looks like for those of you that could feel that on your speakers.
Terrifying, isn't it?
Yeah,
it was so real. It was in my face.
that noise, I could feel all 8 hit dice coming at me. Now, Adam. Chad tells me you have a problem that I actually think is pretty typical of new players in general, really even veteran players to a certain degree, that you have a real issue naming your characters.
It's agonizing. I mean, you spend so much time building up this whole history to the character, and you love it so much, but what do you call it? And I've named a few characters, but it never fits. It never feels right.
You go beyond not being able to figure out a name to not... wanting to name your character.
Yeah.
And not calling
the
anyone.
Process is so painful, it's just become distasteful.
All right, well, let's handle this one side at a time. Now, being unable to name your characters, I don't know about you, but for me, unless this was a character I'm recycling from another game, mm-hmm. which, by the way, if you've been RPing for years and years and years, is a great way to get past writer's block, is take an old concept and recycle it, making it better this time around, and you've got an instant character. But unless I'm doing that, I probably spend more time on that one line at the top of the page than I do everything else combined.
I can come up with the birth, life, and death, history, appearance, personality quirks of a character off the top of my head. Name? Nothing.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. The history endears the character to you. The name's just the name. That's why when you spend so much time on it, it drives me nuts.
You know, but it's significant enough because you want it to be something that sounds good and you can kind of get into. That it's not like an NPC. I mean, with an NPC, you need volume of names.
Right.
But if I have an NPC...
You just need a baby book for that.
Right. But if I have an NPC with a dumb name, I don't care.
Right.
But when your character's name, I mean, you care about that.
Oh, I've solved that. I've come up with a name that is endeared to me.
Adam, what is that name?
I name every single one of my characters Adam.
All right.
When you address Adam, you're usually talking to Adam.
And see, and that rolls us from unable to name the character to unwilling to name the character.
Yes.
And further to perspective of roleplay, Adam, you don't talk from character to character. You talk from player to player.
You're right, I do.
As an example...
I'm a bad gamer.
Yeah, as an example,
it's just
like
one way to do
John
it.
And I roleplay, and it'll be like... You know, John's playing the king, I'm playing the knight, and be like, Lord, I have come and I have slain the dragon. Now, if Adam was in my place, he would look at me, the game master, and say, well, I tell John that I have come and slain the dragon.
And while I don't quite put that English on my Lord like Chad just did, that is more or less accurate.
Every character, every time. Lord!
That was our secret. That
would
was,
you like to
heinous.
Buy
Well, I feel like an idiot. That's just basically what it boils down to. I feel like an idiot talking to John, and John's not John, and I'm not Adam.
John's
and
the
what
Lord.
We're talking about isn't real.
Well, I hate to break it to you, Adam, but we're playing characters.
I
want us. This is just ratifying what we're already doing.
And you know what? I'm totally comfortable with you guys. We've been friends for years.
Right.
We've been everywhere together. It still creeps me out.
I don't follow because that's role playing. I mean, you play a role, not. Me playing.
Yeah. When he gamed with us, that was his first role-playing game. And I remember when we first started doing it, trying to get him to name his character, and the concept of naming a character, not getting the name, but the concept of naming a character, he was like, that's LARPing. I'm never going to LARP. That's just LARPing. You name a character and call each other by names? That's just crazy.
And I can't accept, for someone who's new into the hobby, especially if you're even the slightest bit self-conscious, it is very awkward.
It's weird.
To sit around at a table with a bunch of people, and even though you're not LARPing, you're not per se acting,
right,
to pretend to be somebody you're not, you address... I address Chad as Bill.
Right.
And I speak in a slightly different voice, and I say different things. And I can understand there's something wholly awkward, which goes back to a previous podcast where we talked about not doing it in public for that very reason.
It's awkward. I was just going to say, imagine putting us in a table in a mall with thousands of people walking by us, and we're doing this. We're going to be a little self-conscious.
The way I've heard it put is, are we authors or are we actors? Adam plays a very, I'm an author of this game story.
And he's really, really into the story aspect.
Exactly. While the rest of us might get a little dramatic.
You do. You do. When you...
Teeth wrenching, though.
Yeah. When you get into it, it's like, it's not like you sit down and you're there, you're in the zone and you're acting, quote unquote. As a GM, I know that I have to put things in the plot to engage you. Like it's like these encounters and such, I will have to write in there, will this interest and engage Adam? Will this hook him in? And if I can hook in Adam, I know I can bring in the other players, because you're going to be the hardest to hook.
One of the three notes that you write down is, will this hook Adam?
Three.
That's all that's on the McDonald's napkin in front of him is, will this.
Whoa, write it down, napkins?
Will this make interest Adam
for work?
Well, I don't know. There's a lot of situations where... you know, one character does something with the GM, everybody heard it, and then, well, they don't know about that. Well, I tell them about that. Well, what do you say? They were here for it.
I can accept that for the sake of convenience, but you go beyond convenience. Don't use that as a defense as if you were being the actor guy.
All right, now, I want to hit something that John said a second ago here, see if he'll develop that a little bit for us. For those of you that have been following our podcast for a little while, you know that we had a great big dry erase board with all of our subjects on it, our possible topics.
The big board.
Yeah, the big board.
Had.
Well, we still have it, but the big board's been changed, because when we do this podcast, we break the things we talk about down into really
two subject areas.
Mm-hmm. Advice topics, which is like the fake campaign we run and things like that, the how-to-two game, which we do at the end of the show, what we call the banter topics, which is stuff like this. It's just things that are on our mind that really, there's no advice to give. It's just fun to kick around, and, you know, hopefully you guys enjoy listening to us kick it around, and then hop on our forums on feartheboot.com and tell us your thoughts on them. And
yeah, maybe you identify with one of us or against another of us. Yeah.
But we just recently, we had on the big board major discussion topics, and we just cleared it off and replaced it with banter topics that we were brainstorming about to try and come up with a bunch of those. And number 21 right now on the big board.
And we'll get you guys a picture of this when we dig up a camera.
Yeah, we'll try to do it here in
the
next
week or so.
No more
wives of donuts.
No.
But number 21 on there is third person versus first person role playing. And it's kind of what we've been talking about here, with where Adam might say, well, I go over and tell John's character this is a third person RP,
right,
versus, you know, verily unto thee, I
Lord.
Yeah, and your
I
first
bequeath this sword into your gut.
That would be your first person RP.
I need more of that.
Yeah.
So, John, is that what you were talking about with your authors and
that
actors?
That is what I was talking about. How much into it, or maybe even not how much into it, but in what manner do you want to get into it? Are you a detached Lakitu holding the camera behind the action, looking in and kind of guiding it with the invisible hand, or are you Dirk Dumbledore swinging the sword in your own mind? Some people think the first is lazy, or that you're afraid of going into a full character, and some people think getting into full character is a little weird.
Yeah, the one step away from LARPing, and we don't want to do that.
And I actually moved perspective when I joined this group. Chad, you sold me on the first person. Before that, I was I would not have addressed another character in character.
So is that the breakdown here, Chad? First person or third person?
Oh, totally first person.
I'm first person as well.
Yeah.
I don't quite go to the point of LARPing, but first person
RP. I've seen you use props.
Well, I don't know. I don't have a problem with props. I don't have a problem with props if they're used purely as just like, I'm holding this like this or whatever.
Let me ask you this then. Where is that line? Not to say that LARPing is a bad thing, it's just not our thing, but where is that line between the first person perspective and LARPing? When do you start crossing that line? Costumes, props, going out
I'd
to Denny's?
It's one thing. It's when, particularly the physical act of acting,
mm-hmm.
your body movements, your props if you have them, you getting up and walking around, ceases to be an optional aspect of RP and becomes an integral aspect of RP.
Right.
Like, if we're first person RPing and your voice is always literal to the game, if you say,
right. fake British accent,
dear king, you're a jerk, you just insulted the king. But if you're sitting there waving your hands wildly while you're talking, that's you waving your hands, not your character.
Right.
But when you get to the point that those physical acts become integral and important mm-hmm. to the game, not just an optional thing to demonstrate this is how I'm doing it,
right.
I think now you've crossed into LARP.
And we have to remember what the law of LARP is. It's live action. I mean, no matter how into our characters' heads we get sitting around the table throwing the dice, we're not really moving around.
We're still sitting around the table.
Yeah. yeah.
I like the L of LARP, live. As opposed to what, pre-recorded? Pre-recorded role-play is...
You could tape your actions and then dictate them from the couch.
We should start a whole...
In fact, that'd be kind of fun.
We should start a whole counter-movement now. Instead of LARPing, we have perping.
Perping?
Pre-recorded role-play.
Perping. Sounds like I'd get arrested for that.
So, like, as a DM, I just do a quick recording of the setting, and I email that out to each of my friends, and they make a recording of their actions?
Have each player record from start to finish what they think they need to do this game.
Oh.
And you just mash it up. And it's like, Chad, the king asked you a question, and I just hit play, and I just play 15 seconds of you.
The GM isn't even a GM. He's the video editor. And he can edit this mishmash of actions to be truly comedic.
Okay. Special episode number one, females podcast. Special episode number two, we're discussing it.
Perping?
Three is going to be perping.
Three is perping.
We've already discussed
it. So on the ladies podcast, by the way, for anyone who doesn't follow this podcast regularly, or this is your first episode, the episode that's going to be released on Monday, July 17th, we are giving the mics up. We hope. If all goes well, we can't promise this, but we hope. Be giving the mics up to our wives who are going to give a lady's perspective on role play.
Mm. Expect scathing perspective.
Perspectives on the hosts too that really weren't planned. But you want to
know what you're talking
about.
You
want to do a post?
My wife adores me.
Hmm?
You said do you want to do a post? Because you said a follow up on that. So for the next episode,
when we discuss it?
We can do a bonus episode for the discussion.
That's
going to be special episode number one. And then two was going to be one where we watched the Dungeons & Dragons movie straight through and
Don't spoil it!
Well, you can drug it out of me on this
one. Oh, yes. The thumb screws came out on that one.
By mentioning future podcasts, we left you with no choice but to mention...
You've been shaken about this for weeks.
I'm so excited. I heard the second direct-to-DVD movie defended on Fear the Boot. So before I slam it, I've got to see it.
Wait. Who defended it?
I didn't defend it. I just said...
It wasn't you. There was another user, and forgive me for not knowing your username.
It was a forum person.
On the forum.
I had said that I had heard that it was better, which isn't a hard feat.
That's a low bar to jump. Yeah.
I read an article, or somebody told me about it, is that the people who made the direct-to-video D&D movie were...
Summarily killed?
The second one.
Oh, the second one. Okay, the first one.
We're trying to make it more like D&D and to make a little bit better movie.
All right, well,
but no.
What we're going to do, now that Adam's let the cat out of the bag...
I'm sorry.
...is on one of these future episodes, we are going to have a back-to-back watching of the two D&D movies, which I've seen neither.
And then, you haven't seen it?
We're going to come down, we're just going to turn the mics on and go.
There's a beholder in it.
I'm going to have to track down...
By the way, I love special episodes.
I'm going to have to track down the profanity bleep for that episode. Now, he's not here at the moment, but at one of the previous takes on this episode, we had a guy named Phil here. And Phil is terribly guilty of something that I think there's at least
Phil's
one...
Phil's terribly guilty of many things.
Lots of things.
Which one in particular?
One thing in particular. If you imagine a Venn diagram, there's one problem where Phil overlaps with probably at least one member of every gaming group out there. The ridiculous inventory.
Ugh. He's disgusting.
This topic has just washed over me. No one told me this was going to happen. Mm-hmm. And now I'm speechless.
All right, just go.
Let's give some examples here. For example, Chad, since we brought him up, why don't you tell us about what Phil has been guilty of?
Why don't you start?
Yeah, I'm not gonna get into specific characters and specific games, but just think of this concept of you have a futuristic game with guns, right? And you have two guns at the most. You know, you only have two hands, or maybe three. We'll allow three, because we'll say, well, you have one for each hand and then maybe a backup gun, right? No, not Phil. He had his two SMGs on each hip. He had a rifle slung over one shoulder. He had another rifle slung over another shoulder. He had pistols going up and down his chest. He had bandoliers of grenades.
And not little derringers. We're talking 45s over in overalls.
Yeah, I mean, and just an ammunition. Enough ammunition to last a week of constant fighting for all of these guns. And a rocket launchers. And plenty of rockets to go along with it. I mean, double digits of guns. And you know what? As I'm saying this, I'm sure everybody listening to this either A, has somebody in their group like this,
and
or
if you
B,
can't isolate one, you're him.
Yeah. Or B, has an entire group that's like this, and they're thinking, well, what's wrong with that? You gotta have a backup.
Hey, man, you gotta defend yourself. It's dangerous out there.
Yeah. Our example like that is we had somebody in a Battletech game, and I was GMing the Battletech game, and I started to catch on when in every situation, he would just whip out something completely different. And so, and I finally...
Beyond guns, too. Yeah, bro, cigarette lighters, yeah.
Everything.
And well, he was clearly playing MacGyver.
And so I finally said, can I see your character sheet? And he had, like, six different rifles. He had 10 maxi grenades. If you've never played Battletech, a maxi grenade is about the size of... Imagine if you took a football and rolled it into a canister shape. He had a particular kind of battle mech repair kit, which weighs like, like a half-ton push cart.
You need a forklift to move around with. He had it in his pocket.
And I'm just getting started. I mean, this just went on and on and on and on.
Basically, every single piece of equipment in the book that his character could afford.
And I know some people would say that the solution to this is the encumbrance rules.
Some people are named John.
Yeah. John, why don't you defend that aspect before
we
defend
it. I basically see two ways to go about it. There are encumbrance is based on encumbrance rules, and encumbrance is based on how small I can write in the margins of my character sheets over what I'm carrying. I think the rules are good. They're not perfect. Yes, it's a little silly that when I pass this 1 ounce, I immediately move into another category and I go slower. But you know what? Hit points are kind of silly, too. It's an abstraction.
A man runs up to you, hands you a copper piece, and then you have a herniated disc.
I'm not going to have an NPC run up to you, throw you 5 gold so you're encumbered, and then you move slower the next combat. Although, that's pretty clever. I've seen it done in MUDs and stuff.
My take on encumbrance rules is this. I don't think encumbrance rules are always the right way to go, just because they are very paperwork and math intensive.
Yeah, there's too much bureaucracy to it.
That, especially if you're talking about a game like Dungeons & Dragons, where if you are fairly well-equipped for adventuring, you have a pretty long equipment list. Nothing huge, but you have a lot of, like, rope and chalk and a fishing hook and things like that, a block of soap, which I'm actually one of the few people who actually remembers to buy a block of soap for my characters.
Bah, that doesn't help your Thaco.
Yeah, I play barbarians and sorcerers. We don't know what soap is.
But those, you know, you're going to have a pretty long sheet with a lot of junk on there. If you're using the full encumbrance rules, that's a lot of math to keep track of. And that's why I am a firm proponent of a third option, which is common sense. I mean, come on, if you've got a character who's got an extremely low strength and you've got a huge equipment list, or even a high strength,
but
you're carrying around 28 guns and three tons of repair parts.
If you've ever encountered this, well, we'll use Phil as the example because, you know, we love him, but...
You can't reason with him.
You can't reason.
Who's carrying around 48 guns cannot be reasoned with. No.
He will give a reason how and why he has all of this equipment.
Every single
Maybe
gun.
It's the big old lawful in my real-life character sheet, but I don't trust common sense because I don't think it's common.
And then he will look at you also and go, okay, take out his smallest pistol, give it up, put it on the table.
Well, that's what he was
there
even saying,
go.
Is it's insurance.
Yeah.
That he knew you were going to take away some percentage of his equipment.
He's the guy who comes to the party with two keys so he can give up one set, get drunk, and then drive home on the other one.
It was amazing. He was given this argument about how, well, he knows I'm going to take a lot of his guns away from him, so he goes overboard so that he keeps a small percentage of his guns, like a pistol and a rifle. And I'm like, but I let people have, like, a pistol and a rifle.
I have more weapons than that.
I know.
See, this is the common sense system being exploited by a crafty player.
Well,
right
no, this
before
is,
your eyes.
The problem here is the same problem that existed in that Battletech game I was running, which is something I've since fixed. GM oversight. And I don't mean micromanaging a character sheet, but when you're getting ready to start that first game of that campaign or whatever, have everyone pass you their character sheets and just skim them.
Yeah, give them a once-over.
Yeah, just give them a once-over.
For the glaring things.
And it's like, wait a minute, you have six rifles. How are you possibly carrying six rifles? And they don't have a really good explanation that, well, that's why I have the mule on the flip side who carries my equipment for me or whatever.
Traveling arms
the mule,
merchant.
Why do you need six rifles?
Well, Nodwick the henchman.
Now, see, the need I wouldn't worry about because, in my mind, it's their character. If their character wants six rifles, that's fine. All I am concerned of is this feasible? I mean, is this something you can reasonably be carrying?
You know what? The next game we play, I'm going to play an arms merchant.
Play Phil Hicks.
I'm playing an arms merchant right now in a Star Wars game.
Really? Yes. Do you have 10,000 weapons?
I have a lot of guns, and I have gun-making skills. But that's neither here nor there. Yeah. Dan?
Yeah. Just out of curiosity, is that a West End or a D6 Star Wars game?
It's D20.
D20,
West End is D6.
West End is D6. Yes. I meant West End or D20. It's a D20. Okay.
No, D6 is a little gross, even for me, and I'm a pretty gross guy.
D6 is wonderful. It's Yahtzee.
Yeah, it's like Yahtzee.
You get to play Star Wars and Yahtzee at the same time.
Greatest game ever.
All right, so real quick with the encumbrance rules, my take on is use common sense, be reasonable. I don't care why the players do it. GMs, give a little oversight. Chad, your nickel opinion on it?
Eh.
Yeah. Great.
I don't know. Well,
and this is why you end up with Phil. Yeah. Adam?
Encumbrance rules.
Oh, really? Full-blown encumbrance, just like John.
There's a good man. Full-blown encumbrance rules.
Stones and pounds and all that crap.
Listen, you think that I don't like the rules. I love the rules. But Chad hates the rules. Yeah. And Chad runs the games. So I have to accept
the non-rules.
It's not
that much work. I mean, you're carrying 10, 15
items. It's not
that
much work, and we do all the math. You just have to roll the dice.
Here's why I let Phil have it. It's the carrot.
Oh, my God.
John
hates, another discussion.
John hates the carrot, and it's the carrot and the stick.
I love the carrot. I don't like the superfluous, nonsensical carrot.
Phil doesn't get to do a whole lot of combat, which is why he's there. So I let him have a shiny, like a gun or something like that, and I at least I know he has all this ridiculousness, and I can plan for it. Otherwise, he'll do something else.
He's going to do it anyway, Sally. We better buy him some condoms. That's what I've heard from you.
Now, we talk a lot in this podcast about balancing storytelling versus rules. And we, of course, talk about both sides of that. The people that want zero rules just move forward the story versus the people that want huge amounts of rules for the great detail and, of course, everything in between. And with that, sometimes you run into a rules lawyer. Someone who says, you know, you can't throw a fireball that way because on page 37 it says this about that. You know, nobody even cares. It's just getting in the way of the. It's a simulation, not just
right.
encroaching on the story, but it's a simulation smashing the story for no really good particular reason. And most people know a rules lawyer and don't like them and.
Or some people are the rules lawyer and they love themselves.
Right, I have no idea what we're talking about. But let's not talk about rules lawyers. I want to talk about a different kind of lawyer. I want to talk about a setting lawyer, and I want to see if anyone at this table has ever had to deal with a setting lawyer.
Now, when you first told me about this concept, I had seen it before, but I didn't know what it was.
Right,
what is a setting lawyer?
Let me give an example of a setting lawyer. Let's say, let me give a real-world example. Now, I did not run into a setting lawyer, but I had the opportunity
to.
I could have.
Yeah.
I like to run Forgotten Realms when I run D&D. It's my preferred campaign setting. And the reason it's my preferred campaign setting is because I played a lot of the old gold box games, like Curse of the Azure Bonds and things like that, the original Pool of Radiance. And so I really like that era and that campaign setting. I own an old box set of Forgotten Realms that goes back to the day when like Moander was still still around and hadn't been crushed yet and whatever. But I
remember those days, John?
Oh, yeah. I was great on the walls of my mother's fallopian tube, just hanging out, assembling myself.
I think he's calling us old, Dan.
Yeah, I know. He is.
I'll beat you with my cane, boy.
Well, don't worry. Tables will be turned when he's paying my Social Security, so...
Mm-hmm. You think it's going to last till you get old?
Joke's on you. It won't be there.
Yeah, anyway.
Oh, snap.
But I don't read the novels or anything like that. Of course, there's been vast amounts. Yes, they are.
A novel is written.
And they've been written in vast quantity. I mean, there's huge amounts of novels, but I don't read them. And so when I sit down to run this game and I say to them, okay, you guys walk into this particular town, like you guys walk into Waterdeep or whatever.
These guys do read all
right.
of the novels.
And I was running, in this game, I had two people in there, Kevin and Tim, who have read a lot of these D&D novels. And when we walk into town, I may say, okay, you guys walk in and there's the silver dragon inn on your left.
Or the golden phoenix or
and
the red
if these guys had been,
color plus animals.
Exactly. Color plus animals and then in D&D. Any color, any animal, you've got an inn in D&D. The chartreuse hamster is somewhere in there.
What a great inn. I can imagine what that place is like.
I can see it signed. There's a hamster outside and he's drunk.
I've heard they have great service.
But if they had been real big setting lawyers, they could have jumped on me, just as somebody would about the misuse of Fireball or whatever, and said, oh, no, that's not true. This is over here and that's over there. Or, as an alternate possibility, which may even be in some ways worse, be setting, not just setting lawyers, but setting exploiters, where we walk into Waterdeep, and their whole campaign is centered around undead. And they're like, well, you know what? There's this one level 42 wizard who lives in Waterdeep who absolutely hates undead more than anybody else in the realm. And if we came to him and approached him like this, there's no way he wouldn't help us. And here's proof out of this novel, and out of that novel, and out of this novel.
Burn your books, lads. Yeah. He's not there.
Has anyone here, and I've seen this happen in other groups. I've overseen this happening. Like, I'm walking through a gaming store past a table where people are gaming, and I've seen it go down. Mm-hmm. Now, I fortunately have never had to deal with it, and I'll tell you why in a minute. But before I get to why I've never had to deal with it, has anyone sitting here ever had this happen to them?
I have. I'll mention my Star Wars game again, just because it happens to be appropriate. There are probably 3, 4, 5 Star Wars guys in this group that read the books, and all of them, not to mention have seen the movies 100 times. And when you get a bunch of setting lawyers together, and they can all agree on it, and they can all zoom in onto every last little hair follicle on every extra character, they love it. I mean, it's a great time for them. But I would say
it's like playing Trivial Pursuit and role-playing.
Exactly.
At the same
they show
time.
Off their knowledge and they're in the game. But I would say unless you have everyone in the group at that level, don't go there or willing to go there. I'm not at that level in Star Wars, but I like the story. I'll play along, even though I don't really know how many hairs Count Dooku's beard has. Anyone else?
Well, no. For me, I've never encountered that, but I don't run a certain game because of that. And that game is Dune. And I've always wanted to run or play in a Dune role-playing game, but it's so setting-specific, and it's like either one of two things are going to happen. One, I will encounter players who, and I've read a lot of the books, and I know a lot about Dune, but there's always somebody out there who knows more, and they'll call me on stuff. Or I'll get players who've maybe read the first book or haven't read it at all, and they're just lost, and I'm throwing out words and vocabulary and names and places, and they just can't identify with it and don't care.
You're being your own setting lawyer.
Yeah, I am. Yeah. I'm running my own setting lawyer.
Chad, that sounds like fear. Fear is the mind killer.
Fear is
the little death through which all other defeat is possible.
You guys
blah, blah, blah.
Setting lawyer the podcast.
Oh my God, we did.
John Grant, I love you.
All right, let me tell you guys why I've never had to deal with this. Some simple steps I've taken to avoid ever having to deal with this. Step one, most important step, is get a group of people that aren't jerks.
Mm-hmm.
And that's part of it. You know, I sit down with people. I know they're there for a good game. They're going to give me some swing room on this. An example in reverse is right now Chad's running a Battletech game that I'm playing in. I know the Battletech universe really, really well.
You know it better than I do,
right,
by far.
But
easily.
I don't argue with you about it.
No.
You know, when you're like, well, this is what happened, I'm like, okay, that's what happened.
Even though it didn't happen in the history, in the context.
It couldn't possibly have happened that way, and one phone call would have fixed the problem. You know, I'm not going to do that. And when things do come up that I have questions about, I'll just say, like, look, in Battletech, every mech warrior has his own tech and Aztec. Do you mind if I take 2 NPCs that are my tech and Aztec?
Yeah.
And you're like, no, that's cool. So, okay, there I go.
Aztec.
Well, assistant tech.
Yeah, I know. I just worked that out. Aztec, that's hilarious.
It's actually in the Battletech books. It's A-S-T-E-C-H. Aztec is short for assistant tech.
No, it isn't. It's A-S-S tech. And you know it.
Ass technician. I ain't no ass technician.
Those battle mech seats are hard.
The second way to get out of this, and this is not always an option, but if you're really, really concerned about this or you have a group that's filled with bad setting lawyers, pick a game you know better than they do. And if there's no game that you know better than they do,
make one up.
It's time to come up with your own setting.
Yep.
And we're not going to talk about that because creating your own settings.
Oh,
and,
I'm all about
creating
a whole
other series
setting.
Of podcasts. The third thing, and this is probably the biggest tip that I can give anyone on how to avoid this, is set an expectation up front. Say to them, look, And this is what I did with Forgotten Realms with Tim and Kevin. I said, look, I want to run Forgotten Realms. I only know a certain time period, and even that time period I don't know very well. So I just want you guys to accept that, look, I'm going to read the books. I'm not just going to change everything. I'll read my campaign manuals, the campaign setting manuals, and I'll be, you know, things will generally make sense, but you just got to accept this is my Forgotten Realms, not theirs.
Right.
And when you walk into this town, there may be an inn where no one was before, or this city may be a whole lot bigger, a whole lot smaller than it was before, that I'm going to stay faithful to the feel and some of the major bullet points that come out in the campaign manual.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not going to go read 30 novels just to bring myself up to speed to run a game that may only go a couple sittings.
Right.
The advice topic for today is encounters.
Mm-hmm.
And by encounters, we're specifically talking about combat encounters. Your party runs into a hostile bunch of monsters, angry townspeople, whatever.
Bugs.
I'm giving that clarification because depending on the role-playing book you read, the true definition of encounter is any event that gets in your player's way.
You walk into an NPC to buy a book.
Yeah, that's an encounter.
Roll for initiative.
Dun, dun, dun.
Well, even things like you come to a locked door. Some of
your
the older role-playing books.
Encounter with the door.
Yeah, seriously, some of the old role-playing books define that as an encounter
but
in the
Dan,
plot.
What's the door's motivation?
Ooh. What's the door's initiative?
That's true. How many hit dice does that door
have? Well, you know, all right. I don't think we need to go that far because there's no reason to really take such a wooden interpretation of the
rules. Oh!
You're fired.
You
left us wide open for that one.
Oh!
Yeah, you left that one open. I just walked through. So.
Oh, God. Double stick.
Double
like
something.
A bad deodorant.
All right, let's talk about it. So we are talking about combat encounters here. Let's go ahead and talk about those. The first thing we want to talk about is encounter design, and this is going to be real quick because I don't know that there's a whole lot to say about encounter design. When you're making an encounter, make sure that it will challenge your players without overwhelming them.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you've ever played a first-person shooter like Doom in God mode, you know it's fun for about all of 20 seconds, and then the game loses all of its appeal because there's no challenge. So, but on the flip side, if you play Doom on some of its harder difficulty settings, especially when you first pick the game up, you just get splatter with
yeah.
no prayer of survival, and that's equally unfun. If you're a newer GM, this you're the type of person that's going to struggle with this. I think an older GM, you just learn how to kind of feel out how the encounters are going to go. And you won't be right 100% of the time, because sometimes just the dice won't go your way, or the characters will fail to do something you thought they would do, that you know, they're carrying the anti-goblin gun, but for some reason nobody's drawing it against the goblins. And
I don't want to waste my ammo.
Well, that's never happened in our game.
Yeah.
But if you're a newer GM and you're not sure how to balance your encounters for the party,
mm-hmm.
the first tip, as I say, is look at the role-playing books, because some games like D&D have a built-in encounter chart that's not perfect. I think there's some monsters and they're smoking crack when they came up with their challenge rating, but they're pretty good. If that's not the case, you're not playing a game like that, here's the easy rule of thumb. Design out an encounter party that looks very similar to the party itself in terms of abilities and skills. You can mix them up a little bit, you know, but healing and armor on the same guy instead of different guys or whatever. Mix it up a little bit, but make sure the number of hit points, the amount of damage they can do looks pretty similar to the party, and then tone it down about 10 or 20%. And now you've got an encounter that will probably challenge the party without overwhelming them.
Yeah, the DM guide, 3rd and 3.5 edition, I believe, says to make encounters such that your party will have to rest after 4 or 5 of them. Now, I don't think there's any magic in that number. I don't think the guy who wrote that was a bodhisattva, but it's about right to me. You should come out with some bumps.
I go a little stronger than that, because I think the 4 or 5 encounter thing is geared towards people that do heavy combat dungeon crawls. Because in my games, you typically, between long periods of rest or major plot points, I mean, you're going to see one fight, maybe none, maybe two.
In your, because I haven't gamed with you as a game master in several years now. Nowadays, in one game setting, like everybody shows up, you do a game, you go home. One game setting there. How many combat encounters are there? Separate combat encounters are there on average?
It depends on the point in the plot, but I'd say anywhere from 0 to 2.
How many do you think are in my games?
On average, less than one.
Yeah. Usually, I do about one every other game.
That's about what I would put it at.
If I had to work out an exact average of my games, I'd say it's probably about one a game.
Hmm.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes you'll see two, sometimes you'll see none, but typically it's about one a game because I like the action. I don't like torturing the point.
Right.
And that's why in my games, I typically engineer the fights, and that's where my 10 to 20% rule of thumb came from. I typically set the fights so that the party will survive but need to rest, repair, heal up after one encounter.
See, I think four or five encounters and then needing to rest is ridiculous.
You know, the games I run too, it's like when you get into a fight, it's a major, major thing. And
right.
Even though I don't simulate this, I've been getting better at simulating this, I want there to be consequences, you know. But I usually end up maiming people and injuring people in like permanent sort of ways.
Yeah, avoid fights.
Yeah.
I like my limbs.
That's a question of pacing. You guys put the big rest between each one of your combat encounters. And while I appreciate that style, I don't necessarily think it's the most common one.
No, it's not.
I think these games are written up to go pop, 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 rest, instead of pop, rest, pop, rest.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, if that's the case, if that's the way you're running your games, take my rule of thumb 10 to 20%, and you probably want to tone that down to take about 25 to 50% off the power level of the party.
Yeah.
You know, I guess it depends on the game, because thinking back, even like in D&D, I'm not big into the huge dungeon crawls.
No,
but if they've done something like they've gone into the ruins of the ancient temple, I guess now think about it. Yeah, you might see 2, 3, 4 combats in that one building. You know, there's a couple guards by the door, there's a monster lurking around the back chambers, and then there's the high priest of the Fallen Order, who's kind of like a boss fight. So I guess I there are times, particularly in D&D, I do a couple fights back-to-back. But I usually run sci-fi, and when I run sci-fi, it's at 0 to 2 average per setting.
Well, especially when I run sci-fi, I want it to be dirty. I want it to be, you know, these people have guns, and when you get shot with a gun, you're dead, more or less.
And this gets really more into game design, but actually something that brings up that is somewhat relevant to encounters is a debate where I fall on the injury side of this, hit points versus injuries. That do you have a numeric pool that says I have 50 hit points, or do you have no hit point pool, but when somebody hits you, you roll die and say, oh crap, they just broke my arm, and here's the consequences for that.
I'm more on the side of, well, like I just said, I maim my players. I typically try to avoid outright killing my players, although my players tend to want me to kill more of them, because I do it so...
No, that's John. That's me. I want the death.
Yes. But I want to... I want there to be consequences. Like, if there's a guy standing in front of them, and the character's to the point where he's ready to pull out a gun and take this man's life, I find that in most role-playing games that I've been in, it's such a casual thing. Whereas a role-playing game is supposed to be a fantasy simulation of life. You know, you have aliens or dragons, right, that sort of thing. But there's still life, and in real life, killing somebody's a pretty big deal.
Right, and you know, and I don't want to get too sidetracked onto the exact mechanics of it, because, like the wounds versus hit points,
right,
I hit on there real briefly, because we want to do a whole series on game design and rule mechanics and things like that. But actually, you went a slightly different place with that is relevant to what we're talking about with encounters.
You mean I didn't take it into a tangent?
No, you actually took my tangent and put it right back on track. Can you believe that?
A fear the boot first.
It is a fear the boot first.
And it's amazing. You didn't even read your outline.
A 4th of July miracle.
I scanned it.
You didn't scan the outline. You threw it on the ground in front of me and said, hey, there's your outline.
Pick it up.
But you're talking about the element of real-life courage and fear that should go into an encounter that isn't there. And I think that also can get into the types of encounters that you engineer. And this is also going to get into something that's actually the next topic today. It's moving through encounters. We're going to talk about encounter consequences here in a second. But when you set the scale of an encounter and the possible consequences of an encounter, that can help to push some of that real fear into the game. Because in a real life setting, you know, if I right now was a psycho and pull out a gun on you guys,
right,
I mean, there'd be some real fear. There'd be some real hesitation about trying to jump me.
Yeah. Whereas or negotiate, it's...
Whereas in a role playing game, it's like, well, it does a D8 damage and I've got 25 hit points and
it's not going to kill me.
It might not hit me. It might hit John's character.
And I'm stronger than he is, so by round 2, I'll have the gun out of his hand. So,
yeah.
But, you know, some people, I guess, would argue I'm not one of them, but just playing devil's advocate here. Some people would argue that that's better because the point of a role-playing game is to have that sense of heroics.
Right.
And that sense of where they want to be able to leap into the dragon's mouth without any fear that's the fantasy element to them.
I think that's what D&D tries to simulate. I think D&D tries to simulate that you're not playing just a person, you're playing a hero. And that if you as a real person get shot with an arrow and it's a pretty good hit, you're going down and hurting. But in D&D, that's not the case. You get hit with 37 arrows, and you're about halfway. Feeling pretty good. You're a walking porcupine, please.
Yeah, I think we saw a move that way from second to third, especially made manifest in the character creation rules. Mm-hmm. In second, you were made like everybody else in the universe was, 3d6 down the line. In third, there was this spiel about, well, you're a hero, right, and you're special, so you have better stats and this, that, and the other.
Whereas I think
they've been separated into, you have commoner classes now that have like seriously reduced hit points.
Right. Yeah.
All right, let's talk, though. Or did you have an idea you wanted to?
Well, I was just going to go the other way with it, too, is that, you know, about some systems that are brutal, brutal systems where you get shot once or twice and you're toast.
Right.
But go on.
Okay. Let's talk real quick about encounter consequences. And I want to talk about encounter consequences in two ways. One is that of equipment, and two is of injury, which injury we've been kind of kicking around. But with loot, I think this one's pretty straightforward. Think about the loot you're giving the party. And when you're giving them loot, remember that the loot is not just the treasure chest behind the monster. It's also whatever was on the monster. And what I mean by that is we've had role-playing games where they want to challenge us, and so they have some guy stomping out in massive powered armor with a big old cannon, and we kill him, and the game master never thought through to the point we'd take his powered armor and his massive cannon.
Right.
And now all of a sudden we're strutting around with a power he never intended us to have.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think there's a whole lot to say on this issue. Just have some common sense.
Yeah.
Don't give them so little they can't function. Don't give them so much that loot loses its significance.
With the powered armor example, I think a lot of GMs will take the tack of, oh, well, I can fudge it. I can just say, oh, the batteries die.
Exactly.
But you know what? I don't like that. Because, if you once in a game, I can buy it. Twice in it. You do it three times, it's like, okay, come on. You're doing too many puppets.
Yeah, the rusty broadsword of the beginning player's manuals. The gnolls die. Well, I take their spears. Well, they're rusty.
They just did 1d6
to me. Yeah. Well, they're not worth anything.
They certainly killed Fred over there.
In my opinion, I completely agree with you. I think that's bad GMing.
Yeah.
If a GM is constantly having to reach in and play Deus Ex Machina or pulling puppet strings all the time with, you put me up against this guy with like this big blazing mega sword, and when I pick it up, it just turns to dust.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a personality trait of a certain GM, one who like really, really has to control what happens in the game instead of letting the players loose on the world. You know, it's like you have this working, running world where things are happening, whether the players are there or not, and now the players are interfacing with that world.
And seeing the real break of the equation here is when a GM pulls puppet strings, it should be to fix an unexpected player action. But in the example we just gave, who caused the problem? The GM
did. Yeah.
The GM gave them access to something so ridiculously out of scope, he can't handle them having it. And so then he has to reach in and pull puppet strings to undo his own damage.
I want to see how a player would react with, you know, say it's Shadowrun, and they're street thugs on the street, and now they have this super illegal powered armor that they could go take over the world with. But there's street thugs on the street, and there's 28 bullet holes in this thing, and it's sparking and flying apart. I want to see what the Shadowrunners will do with this.
Right. And, of course, you've always got to accept the possibility that, you know, they may actually figure out a way to fix it and forge the licenses for it or whatever they're going to do.
That's a dangerous road to go down, though. And there are sometimes when you can't even help it.
But that's why you just don't give it to. In my own games, we'll take the example of D&D. There have been times that I've thought about giving away things like rings of like teleportation or invisibility. Ooh. And the minute I start putting the game, I'm like, you know what? Player X is going to annoy the hell out of me with this.
Yeah.
They're going to use it, abuse it, and screw with it. And so it's like, I just put a line right through it, and instead it becomes a ring of protection +2 or whatever. It's not going to be that because think through the consequences of these encounters. When you kill a guy, things are going to drop. You're going to have to live with being in the game and in your character's inventories now for a good long while. Injury. And I don't know, we've got a whole lot more to say on injury, because we hit that one pretty well. But how would you deal with it? Let's say you're running a D&D game where there are supposed to be 3, 4, 5 back-to-back fights.
Mm-hmm.
And if they're not getting injured enough, that's easy to fix. You just put another kobold or two in the next encounter.
Just keep stabbing them.
Yeah. But what do you do when you get the reverse problem where you had an encounter you thought would beat them up a little bit, but they come out, you know, basically okay, yeah, but because of bad dice and such, you suddenly have a party full of corpses.
Well, you know how I run it. I let it roll. I let them see how they deal with it, because I've done this in D&D games where or not D&D game, Battletech games, where we would go on the map, and I want to beat them up because I want the next events when we roleplay to them be, how do I fix my mech, where do I get the equipment, right, and negotiate and all that sort
Objection,
of stuff.
Objection, perjury, sir. How many times have I seen you tip that D20 when it was a bad roll, and maybe
always
it missed
your guy's
the hammer?
Favor.
Yeah. Well, you just said you like to roll with the bad hits. Always in your guy's favor is what I'm telling you, you actually do.
Yeah, I know. No, I'm saying that what we're saying is when the players win when you don't necessarily want them to.
No. Dan's saying no. When the players are more screwed up than you thought they were going to be.
Yeah, you send them into a room with three thugs.
I misunderstood.
Yeah, you send the players into a room with three thugs, and you thought the players would beat these guys up, take a few pummels.
Oh, and then they got throttled.
But by the end of the battle, the whole party's dead.
Yeah, I edge D20s.
Yeah. Or the party's not dead.
Yeah, there's no rolling with it with Chad.
Yeah, I cheat.
You don't edge, you just move
the
dice.
I stick my finger out. Okay, he rolled a 1, the bad guy rolled a 20, Adam's head is lying on the ground, rolling off into the distance.
It nudges the D20, and now he rolled a 4.
Yeah, and because my thing is, and this is something that John and I go back and forth on.
We do disagree, because I think this is doom on God mode.
Yeah, and I can't totally disagree with you. But my problem is that I take the players, and I take their characters, and I try to integrate them into the story as much as possible. And when one of them dies, that means my next three ideas, games, are irrelevant, and I want to see how that plays out.
Yeah, and I would agree.
And I don't want the characters sitting there making a new character.
I would completely agree with what you just said. And so imagine me repeating everything word for word you just said. But I would also add on top of that, that there comes a give and take.
Mm-hmm.
That you cannot expect your players to regularly invest a huge amount of energy, depth, and creativity into characters when one game into it, you're going to annihilate them.
Yeah.
Because what's going to happen is they're just going to start, yeah, they may go real crazy the first time, but on each character, you're going to notice that background personality getting a little shorter and a little shorter and a little shallower and a little shallower.
There's nothing worse than sitting in a game as a player and everybody's playing and you're 2 hours into this gaming session and your character just died and you're sitting there while they're having fun rolling dice and making up a character. And you want to get done as quickly as possible.
Right.
So you're either going to make a carbon copy of what you just made, or make a really shallow character.
But I do see another side of that, and this may be where John's coming from.
Yeah, I will concede you guys all of these points.
In that, if you do it that our way, do you risk taking away consequence from combat?
This is what I'm afraid of.
Let me give you an example of why I had to put death in my campaigns. Because when we first started, and it was Adam's fault.
I was going to ask you to tell this story.
Yeah.
Oh,
it was Adam's fault. We used to have no death because I came from your games, Dan, where nobody died.
Right.
But nobody abused it either.
Right.
We were playing Battletech, and it was a military campaign. There was a military base. The military base was getting invaded, and it wasn't on map. It was personal combat, and we were role-playing it out. And
you were supposed to get annihilated, weren't you? Just get rolled over.
Well, yeah, you guys were supposed to run for it.
Yeah.
I mean, that was basically, you were supposed to run for it, hit the mechs, and then take it to the map. But it wasn't working out that way, and you guys got pinned down, and there was a hover tank coming down the road, full bore, straight for the guys, and Adam stood there, looked at me, and he said, well, I'm not going to die, so I'm just going to walk out into the street and hold my hands up in front of the tank. And I just stared at him.
See, what I found works...
Like, you weren't going to kill me.
I know!
See, what I found works, that where you... In my mind, you don't need to kill a character, is you... Let me first kind of wrap up a point we were working on, then I want to move from that towards character death, which is our final topic for
today.
That's
the next point on the list.
I know.
Of course, you knew that, right, Chad?
List?
If you've got a party that's damaged beyond what you thought it was going to be, I treat it just like I would any other screwed up plot point. And we talked in one episode, so I won't say it was last episode, wasn't it, about plots?
Yeah.
About, or rather, not plots, but when
players screwing up plots?
Yeah, when players screw up the plots. And in my mind, this is another unexpected plot event, which you can resolve in the exact same way as you would a screwed up player plot event. You can have an NPC come in and intervene. You know, you can have the cops show up at the last second and the bad guys just run for it.
Yeah, but that's, again, that's puppet strings and Deus Ex Machina. Well, it's like, and that's okay.
Oh, and helping with a D20 isn't?
Well, it is.
But you've got to take it.
It totally is.
You've got to take it as something to do with great care. That if you had to do it, you better be sure that this is not something that's going to happen on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. There should be a good reason this had to occur.
Yeah.
I'm a believer in go ahead and do it. If you've got to reach in and tweak the situation to keep the story going, I mean, go ahead and do it. Just don't make a habit out of this.
Right.
Let's go ahead and back up, though, to something that you guys were talking about here, which is character death. And we've already thrown out some points on it. So let's go ahead and kind of take that through to its conclusion. And then I'm going to give some thoughts I have on why it is not necessary to kill a player. So the basic for and against we have is if you kill the player, the for is that it helps add a sense of consequence and reels them to the game.
Yeah.
It adds a healthy fear.
When a person pulls out a gun, that isn't necessarily the first response to whip out their piece and blow some holes in somebody. You know, before they touch that gun, they got to think, I'm going to get maimed. I'm going to get killed.
Right.
Exactly.
Can I role play around that?
And once again, Doom is only fun if you die after you get shot enough times.
Exactly.
Right. The second, the counterpoint to that, rather, is that if you allow the players to die, first of all, it can tear them out of the plot. If you wrote a plot that's integrated with their backgrounds to get them involved, which I think is a great practice, they're now gone, which has screwed up your plot. Secondly, it's going to, over time, have a psychological human effect on the players, which is they are going to work less and less on each of their characters because the very real possibility they're going to die is not, they're going to be like, you know, look, I don't want to sit here and pour my heart and soul into this character just to have him killed.
Yeah.
Or even they may even be, look, man, I've had to design 8 characters for this one campaign. I'm out of ideas.
You need to be more careful and leave that gun at home.
Absolutely, yeah.
And, you know, maybe there is some of that. The take on it I've always had is I think there's a simple way to deal with this. The first thing is kill stupid players. And this sounds like I'm contradicting everything I just said, but I'm not. If someone steps out there, we had a Battletech game where we had a map combat going, and it came down to, like, the player's side had basically been wiped out. The bad guy's side was down to 1 beat-up mech. And there's a guy in our group who had ejected from his mech, had a gun, which if you did the conversion between Battletech and mech war, actually was sufficient to do 1 point of damage to a mech. And this thing was bad. I mean, it was in bad shape. Mm-hmm. He said, I'm going to pull out a pistol, and I'm going to start shooting at the mech. And I said, I mean, this in my mind is heroic or dumb, you decide.
Yeah.
But I said, look, you've got to understand, that thing is an 80-some-odd ton, giant machine, armor plates, even beat up. This thing is going to kick your butt. It's got all these cannons and stuff. If you do this and it shoots you, you are dead. Because now you've gotten to the point, the opposite extreme, where with, like, Adam, well, I'm not going to die.
Right.
And he said, I want to do it. I said, okay. He fired his shot. He didn't do much to it. It fired its shot. He was vaporized. And that was death. Because you have to have...
Was he pissed?
Oh, no, no. He understood. He fully understood.
Was it me?
No, it was not you.
Oh, okay.
But you have to, you know, I think you can have the healthy fear not just be of death itself, but of the fact that the GM will eventually go to death.
Right.
You're not afraid of dying. You're afraid of the GM taking death off the shelf and making it a possibility.
Now, so you're offering a mortality warning as a compromise between Chad and my own position, where characters do die, but only with much heraldry.
The thing is, John, I agree with your position, and I try and move towards it. My problem is that when my players die, it starts screwing up my story, and
gotcha.
I can't let that go. And that's a personal thing, and we talked about that, too, about kind of letting go of your letting
exactly.
the players alter your story.
I would politely accuse that story then of being a little train tracky. And you know, when a player dies, that's kind of the GM's problem.
Nobody can accuse my stories of being train tracky.
No, not you, not you. But I'm just saying
they would need structure.
Yeah.
And notes.
Your stories aren't even like Kari or Bodhi.
Not even Bodhi?
They're just vapor.
And I don't want to get too much sidetracked on that too much because we've talked about it in previous podcasts. But yeah, just, I mean, there's always a balance there, a nice engineering balance of you've got on one hand flexibility and on the other hand depth. And unfortunately, yeah, the more you have one, the less you have the other. So, but anyways, getting back to a character death, my comment number one is do make death possible,
yeah,
but only for extreme situations. My rule number two, there are consequences other than death. And I've had games where if somebody goes out into combat and they get mangled, I will not kill the character, but I will do things like, well, for the next 1 hour of game time, your character's in the med bay while mm-hmm. robots piece him back together. Or, yeah, you came out of this okay, but you're going to take, for the next two game sessions, you've got a temporary attribute reduction of such as off your strength and such off your dex.
Oh, I don't do temporary things. I gouge eyes out. Yeah. I cut arms off. It isn't temporary. And I do it.
Well, okay. All right.
I don't want to sidetrack on it too much. That's getting into the wounds versus hit points thing. But that's along the lines I'm talking yeah. about. Another example is we wrote a game that was a post-nuke game, survival game, extremely brutal,
game.
Realistic combat. And in that game, a guy...
Of course it's a great game. We made it.
Yeah, exactly. But in that game, a guy wandered down into these horribly infected, nasty sewers to try and get back possession of his he'd gotten robbed of. And it was, of course, it's a deadly game, deadly mm-hmm. situation. He walked down there. The guy shot him in the foot. And
in this disgusting, gangrene-filled sewer.
And he got horribly infected, lost mm-hmm. use of that foot. So I didn't kill his character. His character's still in my plot, still in my campaign. He doesn't have to go re-roll, but he has now suffered something that's going to make him think twice about getting into combat again.
Right.
So grievous consequence short of removing the
Shy
character from the game.
But you always leave that possibility there that if you are just a moron,
I don't know. It's
I will bury you.
This concept of characters, the GM killing the characters, is such a thing where it's stylistic of the GM, how they take care of it. And it's also such a balance issue, too. You know, it's like there's like really, really good consequences if you kill a character. The story.
Keeps the other characters in line.
Keeps the other characters yeah. in line. The realism, the immersion factor. And then there's really bad consequences when you kill a character, too. They have to remake
right.
it and all
that. And you're right. This is hugely group choice
yeah.
style concept. In fact, I've actually seen groups where the players, not the GM, mm-hmm. the players have asked for death.
Yep.
Yeah.
John,
I'm right here.
John's
I've done it.
Over there.
Because I have,
our current
they prefer that yeah. element of challenge and fear.
Our current campaign of BattleTech, John and I are working out his character's
yeah, my character
death.
Is damned. His
yeah.
bullet is in somebody's gun. That's because I have to go away to Rome for a semester and I won't be here, but
so
the point remains on the table.
Yeah. Well, and you've done
you
other games,
too. You can
see
in the future.
Yeah. Really, I would say, as a GM, you need to pull your characters, not just get a feel, but you need to ask each one, how do you feel? Do you want a sudden death game, or do you want me to kind of fudge the thing and nobody dies?
Right.
You know, and will you exploit that or not? I mean,
right.
I guess you can't ask that. And you need to ask each one to get that feel for the balance.
I was going
to
say exactly that. Not just the players as an entity, but player A, player B.
Yep.
Which one's heart won't get crushed when his character dies? Which one maybe almost wants to make another character?
You can kind
character.
Of cushion the death, though. I mean, if yeah. you make a good ending to the character.
Dan, what do you do if you pull your character, your players,
mm-hmm.
and you have five guys, and four of them are all about the death, and then one of them says, no death, I put too much into this character, don't like character death, I won't exploit it.
I wouldn't kill his character. I mean,
you just make him exempt.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I'd put him under my usual rules of if you're an idiot, I'll kill you.
Killing, maiming.
If you're not an idiot, but you just get maimed, I've got to have there be some kind of consequence.
Right.
So you spend an hour sitting out of the game while your character's getting patched up by robots mm-hmm. or whatever the case is. But I guess in my mind, though, that's really not an exception. I'd actually say the other four are the exception.
Yeah.
Because that's my normal operating procedure, is not to kill characters, unless I just have no choice but to vaporize them because they're out of control.
Now, see, I am going from that. I am trying to get to a point to where I kill more players. Not viciously,
right.
but, you know, where I try to bring that realism more into it. And, according to John, fail miserably, but...
No, you do a good job here and there. You don't do a good job here and there, and, yeah. you know, win some, lose some.
Yeah.
All right, so I guess that's it for dealing with encounters. So, hope you guys enjoyed this and got something useful out of it, and we will catch you next time.
See ya.
This has been a production of Fear the Boot. This show is copyright 2006, fully owned by its hosts. The games, movies, and other properties mentioned in this show are the property of their respective owners. Listeners are free to use this show in any non-commercial endeavor as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com.